The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is David Meerman Scott. I'm the co-author of Standout Virtual Events, How to Create an Experience that Your Audience Will Love. And you are listening to my buddy Douglas on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, and thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource that I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. I produce this podcast to help us both keep up with the latest ideas that matter most in the quickly changing and somewhat overwhelming world of modern marketing and sales. My day job is running a marketing agency that helps manufacturers and industrial companies grow faster by taking a sales-based approach to marketing. To learn more about the problems we solve and how we do it, visit salesartillery.com. And if you're one of the many, many listeners who's left a review on Apple Podcasts, I want to drop a little something in the mail to thank you. Details after the interview. All right, enough yakking. Let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome David Meerman Scott back for the sixth time to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about the new book he's co-authored with Michelle Manafi, Standout Virtual Events, How to Create an Experience That Your Audience Will Love. David Meerman Scott is a marketing and business growth strategist, entrepreneur, advisor to emerging companies, author, and public speaker. He spotted the real-time marketing revolution in its infancy and wrote five books about it, including The New Rules of Marketing and PR, now in a seventh edition, available in 29 languages from Albanian to Vietnamese. His most recent Wall Street Journal best-selling book, Fanocracy, Turning Fans into Customers and Customers into Fans, written with his daughter Reiko, was released in early 2020. David considers speaking his art. He cannot sing, dance, or play a musical instrument, but he loves to perform on a stage or at a virtual event. He's delivered in-person events in 46 countries and on all seven continents, and has delivered presentations at hundreds of virtual events. Standout Virtual Events is his 12th book. And interesting fact, David has attended 804 live music performances, including 75 by the Grateful Dead. David, congratulations on Standout Virtual Events, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you, Douglas. I love coming on the show. I don't feel a book is out into the world until I'm actually on the Marketing Book Podcast. So thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Yes, well, thank you. It's a high honor. And yes, maybe I can one day dream of this podcast becoming the, what is it, the New York Times, the record?
The podcast of record.
Yes, the podcast of record. So, yes. That's terrific.
Well, I think it already is. Oh, well, so you just have to put that on your branding, the podcast of record for marketing books in the world.
Excellent. Well, so you are now tied for first place in a member of the Marketing Book Podcast Six Timers Club, which, wow. You know, David, you've written all these books. You've been enormously successful. You've traveled the world. And do you think that maybe now things are going to start going your way?
That's so kind of you. So, well, you know, it's interesting because as you were introducing me, you mentioned I've been to 804 concerts and have presented in events in 46 countries. Well, in 2020, my concert list stopped at 804 on, I believe it was March 1st was the last concert I've been to. And my speaking countries list stopped on, I think it was January. I spoke in Dublin for the first time, Ireland for the first time. And so unfortunately, things are not progressing. But the good news is that I've doubled down on the idea of virtual events, which is super cool.
Yes. And folks should also know, David doesn't like this, but I just got to talk about him a little bit more here. David Merriman Scott is the patron saint of the Marketing Book Podcast. David Merriman Scott was the very first guest.
Yes.
And we've talked about several of your other books, and different books affect different people. And in my working career, two books have had the biggest impact, and they're both written by guys named David. One of them was Ogilvy on Advertising, which mm-hmm. I read right after I got out of the Army and decided I want to go into advertising. And then that whole advertising thing started to kind of peter out after years. And I didn't know what was next. It was like, oh no, this thing I thought was so cool that I loved doing. And then I stumbled upon your book, The New Rules of Marketing and PR, and I saw where the world was going, and I felt like I had a second bite at the career apple, and I certainly did. And that kind of got me rolling in the right direction. So, and I recommend that book all the time to people. But I have to remind them, you got to read the latest edition because you update it about every 2 or 3 years. So
I do. And I appreciate you saying that because, boy, did the world change sort of in the early 2000s. And, advertising or paying for attention doesn't work so well as people can create content online. So it was good that you saw that the world was changing as early as you did, Douglas, because many people didn't and clung with white fingernails sticking onto the edge of the cliff to the whole traditional advertising approach to trying to get attention. And you jumped both feet into the new world, which is awesome.
Absolutely. And I'm glad I did. And I think there's still some folks out there that haven't awakened to that new reality. But at any rate, let me just read from the very end of the book. We are in an unparalleled time in the events business. In-person events are few and far between as we write this, but the opportunity for those who leap into the world of virtual events is huge. Right now, you have what may be a once-in-a-career opportunity to grow and prosper with virtual events while others are waiting for the world to return to normal. We don't think there will be a total return to what once was. Yes, in-person events will return, no question about it. But as virtual events deliver great experiences for participants and benefits to the organizations that host them, their role will be cemented. In fact, we believe the future holds promise for a hybrid approach to events where some people experience the content in person while others have a virtual experience. This is an opportunity. Do not miss your chance to create experiences your audience will truly love. Now is the time. Now is your time. So, David, can the experience of an in-person event be replicated or experienced virtually?
I believe very strongly from having participated in a whole bunch of virtual events and doing this research that the biggest problem with virtual events is when people try to replicate what worked in an in-person event. Mm. They are very different things. You know, one is a theatrical experience. An in-person speaking gig is theatrical. The speaker is on a stage. The audience is watching the speaker. They're usually sitting, can be standing, but usually sitting down in chairs. And the speaker is presenting to the audience. They need to project to reach the last row. They need to have big kind of gestures so people can see them. But a virtual event is very different because it's experienced on a screen. And as a speaker, you don't have the same opportunity to sense what's going on in the room and change your style based on what the audience is thinking and doing. You've just got to go with it. A virtual event is more of a cinematic experience for the audience. And as virtual event speakers or as people who are creating virtual events, we need to really think about that difference, the difference between theatrical and cinematic, because if you do, then you can create the kind of events that people will love, as opposed to just trying to take what you already know and slapping it online. Because, you know, we've all experienced over the last, say, 20 years, that when companies just take what they know in an offline world and put it online, it doesn't work so well. Going back to what we were just talking about briefly, you know, you in the advertising business, and a lot of advertising agencies completely missed the online marketing revolution, because rather than understand the tools of online for reaching buyers, for doing great marketing, what they did was simply create banner ads, because that's what they knew how to do, was to create advertising, right, Douglas?
So, I had to laugh when I saw that in your book.
Yeah.
I was like, yes. And I think some are still doing it. So,
and there still are some that are doing it. And so they were the ones that missed all of the things that were different about marketing on the web, whether it was search engine optimization or creating videos or all sorts of other things that people have gravitated to. And I think the same thing is true of virtual events.
Yes, and it reminded me of how, now I'm a little older than you, like a year or two, but I'm not that old, okay? So, but apparently when radio first came out, I think in the 1920s or so, it was a lot of people just reading from the newspaper. And then when television first came out, it was radio shows with a camera. It was an orchestra,
that's exactly right.
Or people standing in front of microphones. And so it was the same sort of thing. And that's why you talk about how you can't just bring forward what worked in the past. So what is it that makes for a better virtual experience than others? In other words, how are some virtual events getting it right? And how are some just doing it not well, unless they're just simply trying to show us a PowerPoint slide, like a webinar from 10 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the thing that I always think of, is that I've been doing, you know, the traditional old school webinars since back in the day when there wasn't video, and it was just slides over a voice track. And I've done probably hundreds of those old school webinars of slides over a voice track. And I think the first thing to consider is the platform that's being used. And there's a ton of platforms these days. I mean, most of us are familiar with things like Zoom or GoToWebinar, Microsoft Teams as platforms for delivering virtual events. And then if it's a larger event, there's also many of the larger kind of platforms that can manage audience participation and people paying with their credit cards and multiple tracks and so on. So I think the first thing to think about is, how can you use the different tools that are available in the platform to bring the audience in to the event, both as the audience, as the organization creating the event, or the person who's speaking at the event. Because one of the cool things about in-person events, you're physically there. There's the interaction of the audience. There's the interaction of the speaker with the audience. You tell a joke, people laugh. After the event is over, you can meet people in the hallway and say hello. From the stage, you can can do live Q&A. You meet people at the receptions, the cocktail party, the dinners. I mean, all sorts of different ways for speakers to interact with the audience and audience members to interact with one another. Those have been difficult to replicate until recently, and now there's different ways to do that. Some of the platforms are really stepping up for ways to do that. So look at the platform and figure out how can you use the different elements, whether it's breakout rooms or chat or Q&A or the polling question feature that some of the platforms have. Use those to your advantage. Now, as a speaker, what speakers need to think about is in a television model, there's usually a change of scene, a change of set every 5 to 7 minutes. And so if you think about a network news program, for example, they'll do, say, 5 minutes of the, and I'm thinking kind of a morning show, you know, a 2 or 3 hour morning show. They'll do 5 minutes of the different hosts having a quick chat with one another. Then they'll go to a remote feed of somebody out in the field. Then they'll interview somebody who comes in virtually, you know, from their home or wherever it might be. And then they might have some kind of way to have something else come into play. So as a speaker, you need to think about how you can do the same thing. How can you mix it up? Even if you're sitting in your home, how can you mix it up so that every 5 to 7 minutes there's something a little bit different that's popping up?
Yes, and you write on page 29 that while a great virtual event is more like television than theater, that is not the whole story. If you only focus on the TV part, you missed the opportunity for the audience interaction. And then right. You want to say most virtual events fail to provide audience interaction because they simply try to recreate the stage experience from a physical event. They deliver a passive experience for the audience. And I noticed in your book that Nick Morgan is one of your speaking coaches.
Yes.
And I got to interview him about his book, Can You Hear Me?
Yeah.
And a terrific book. And when I found out about that book, I think Harvard Business Review Press emailed me about it. And he'd written it 2 years ago. And I said, clear the decks. I've got to get him on the show immediately. Yeah. This was in March or April. And I remember in his book, not only does he talk about you and your books, but he also has a whole chapter devoted to why there's a special place in hell for webinars.
right.
And he's talking about what we just mentioned about people think that a webinar is basically where you show a PowerPoint deck, you know, a PowerPoint slide. So one of the other things to include there that you all talk about in this book is get yourself on the screen. I want you to talk a little bit more about that because you talk about several times the importance of looking at the camera. It seems to be a big challenge for folks.
It is a big challenge for people to like look at that little red light or look at that camera. And it's so important. And the reason is because you create a very intimate experience if you're talking directly to the audience by looking directly into that camera. And, you know, what's fascinating, Douglas, is since I wrote the book, I had a chance to speak. Actually, it was right around the time I was finishing up the book. I had a chance to speak at Tony Robbins' virtual business mastery. I've spoken at his in-person business mastery since 2014, between 2 and 4 times per year. And usually they get 2,000 people to the event. It's a really energetic, fascinating event. Tony Robbins is there. It's a 5-day event. He presents every day. I mean, it's just a terrific, terrific in-person experience. And they needed to bring it virtual. And they did a fabulous job. They have a huge studio in Florida, and it has a 50-foot round screen in the middle of the studio, 20 feet tall, where the speaker, and I had a chance to speak on August 20th in the studio at the Virtual Business Mastery, the speaker can see 2,000 people on Zoom at any one time. And so the tendency in an environment like that is to focus on the people on the screens. And yes, I would occasionally, and Tony will occasionally, focus on particular people on the screen, but you really have to play to the camera. And it's hard to do because the camera is what, if you're talking directly to the camera in a sort of a casual tone, and the camera person is, in this case, there's a camera person is following you with the right kind of zoom settings, and by zoom I mean how close you look in that camera, then it can work out brilliantly well. And the remarkable thing is, I had 30 or 40 people who had seen me live at Tony Robbins, in person in Tony Robbins, who then saw me virtually at Tony Robbins, who said it was way more intimate in the virtual setting than in person, which is counterintuitive. You would think when you're physically in the room with a speaker that it's more intimate. But in fact, because the audience member, a single audience member might be 30, 40, 50, or even 100 feet away from the stage, it's more intimate to be virtual. But the speakers who don't look directly at the camera, and they're looking at their slides on their computer, or they're looking at an image of themselves, or they're looking at a moderator if they're on a panel or something, their eye is pointed at a different direction than directly at the camera. That is not an intimate experience. That's kind of a weird, disconcerting experience.
I saw someone interviewed on the news who was doing this.
And it's weird to us as humans if someone's talking to us and they're not looking at us. And that's tough it's tough for me. It's still tough for me. I've done hundreds of virtual events. It's still tough to look directly at that lens rather than the natural tendency to look down and at the video of the person that you're speaking with. But it's important to look at that lens.
Yeah, I found that if I obscure everything except the camera, it's easier. In other words, if I'm seeing pictures of people, my eye immediately goes to some of the other people in the meeting or the people.
That's the natural tendency.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And another point that you brought up that I just want to touch on, which is interesting, is that that old school webinar, you're absolutely right, that old school webinar was originally just slides, and it was slides with a voiceover. Super boring. I mean, yeah, you could try to make it exciting, and I would try to mix it up as much as I can and have some surprising slides or try to make a dumb joke in the voiceover part. But it's really hard to do much with that platform. So all of the platforms, whether it's Zoom or GoToWebinar, whatever it is, then figured, now let's put some video in. And they all tended to default to this silly kind of approach where the slides are enormous and the speaker's video on their webcam is a little tiny thumbnail in one of the corners. And it's just kind of a joke. It's like the same webcast webinar that you might have experienced 15 years ago with no video, but it's like video is an afterthought in the corner. It's like this little postage stamp if you squint really carefully, you might see it's Douglas there in that little postage stamp. And so I've actually solved that problem I have a studio in my house that I built. I've solved that problem much in the way that some television studios have solved that problem, where I have my slides on a computer screen over my shoulder in my studio, so that the slides are not being delivered through the platform. The slides are being delivered through a second computer in my studio. I've got two computers. One drives my slides on a screen over my shoulder. The other drives the platform that the event is having. And it's a big screen that I use. I don't know how big, but let's call it 2.5 feet or 3 feet diagonally. And so what people see then, they don't see a huge version of my slides and a little thumbnail of me. They see one video feed of me presenting with my slides on a screen that's just in the same camera shot as me over my shoulder. And that's been transformational. I've been doing that for about 5 months now. It's transformational because it means that whatever platform, whether it's Zoom or something else, can shoot me just as video and not have the slide feature at all running. So I'm huge in the screen, and every other speaker at that event is just that little thumbnail approach.
Oh, interesting. If that was in the book, I missed it. But it sounds just like the Today Show or a television.
Yeah. And that's actually how I learned that idea, because I've done a lot of television over the years. And I recognize it in those studios. They often will do it with a green screen, which I don't recommend, because the green screen technology, unless you have a really, really, really good system, has the ghosting effect, which doesn't work. But I did it as a physical screen over my shoulder in the studio that I present from, and it works great. It really, truly works great as an alternative to the little thumbnail video approach.
Oh, interesting. Well, you touched on that virtual background, and that would apply to anyone listening to this who's been on a Zoom call. Talk about why virtual backgrounds. Okay, there's a little bit of ghosting. Yeah, but there's even more subconscious reasons why that's pretty much a bad idea for anyone who's going to do it. In fact, it is such a bad idea. David Mearman Scott made a hilarious video about why virtual backdrops are such a bad idea. And I'm going to include that video as well as a link to your article about it on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah, that'd be great if you could do that. So here's what I believe. Now, this is a bit of a religious discussion because some people have pushed back on me on this.
And when David Mearman Scott says a religious discussion, think of should we gate our content behind a landing page or not?
Yeah, exactly. And so what I see is someone who's hiding. I see somebody who's does not want you to see what's behind them. Mm-hmm. And I see that it just feels fake. It really, truly feels fake. And especially when there's a background like, you know, the Golden Gate Bridge or something like that. You know, it's like, you know, all right, fine. So you're in San Francisco. I get it. But that's just super weird. And so I just don't recommend those virtual backgrounds. Now, it's different if it's a business Zoom call and, you know, you're talking to people within your company and, you know, your apartment's a little messy. That's fine. I get that. It's totally fine. But if you're presenting at an event, use a real background.
Yes. And like in my, because we moved out of offices, of course, and in my, behind my computer or behind me, I have a little screen, and you even mentioned that, meaning a real screen. I just open up, and it looks nice. It's not a distraction, and until I get my study renovated and painted, it's kind of a mess because it's full of boxes from my office. But it looks nice, but people can see it's a real little backdrop there. It works well.
Cool. Yeah, that would work well. Yeah, great.
So why do you argue that virtual events should be shorter than in-person events?
Well, with an in-person event, a speech is typically 45 minutes or an hour, sometimes longer, and the blocks of time tend to be an hour and a half to 2 hours in between breaks. And that does work for an in-person event when people are seated. However, with virtual events, because we've all been trained as we've been watching television our whole lives, that television is quicker, faster, bang, bang, bang in a commercial break, that I believe that virtual events need to do the same thing. And I've seen some virtual events that the events themselves have been super short. I've seen some presentations, and I've done some myself, that are super short. And, you know, defaulting to the 45 minutes or 1 hour presentation isn't always the right way to go. And it might be better to rethink what you might be able to accomplish. So I presented a couple of weeks ago at an event. I had a 15-minute slot, and it was great. You know, just bing, bang, bong, we're done, and it worked really well. I presented at an event from Vern Harnish, his Scaling Up Summit, Normally, Vern has an in-person event that goes for 2 days. He normally gets 12 speakers. Each speaker speaks for an hour or a little bit more than an hour over 2 days. And I've presented at that in-person event 2 or 3 times. But when he went virtual, he did something that was actually kind of radical. He did a 2-hour event, had 12 speakers. I was one of them. Mark Cuban was another one. So we got great speakers. I don't mean me. I mean Mark Cuban. And each of us had 10 minutes. 10 minutes. And me, man, you've got to really be on point in 10 minutes. And the audience loved it because they're busy, and devoting 2 full days to a virtual event is hard. Now, if you want to devote 2 full days to an in-person event, that makes sense. You're on site, you're in the room, you can devote that attention. But devoting 2 full days to a virtual event is tough. But having that opportunity to see 12 speakers present content, only 10 minutes each, in and out in 2 hours, people loved it, absolutely loved the format. And since then, Vern has recreated that format. I think he's up to his 3rd or 4th or maybe even 5th time because it worked so well.
That's great. And I love hearing stories about people that jump on these things quickly. Earlier when I was quoting from the book, there was a line that said, this is an opportunity. And there may be somebody listening who thinks, well, we've never had events, but wait a minute. Suddenly these virtual events, it seems like this is an opportunity for organizations to suddenly have an event where they never would have thought to have one before.
I think that's right. I think it's an opportunity to do that. I think it's an opportunity to stand out in really interesting ways, which is why we use that word in the title, standout virtual events. And, you know, I think of it much like when YouTube first started. You know, when YouTube first started, I think it was 06, if I'm not mistaken. You know, people expected that some of the big brands would be the ones that would be the initial successes on YouTube. But it wasn't. I don't know if you remember, but there was that small blender company.
Oh, Blendtec. Yes.
Yeah, Blendtec. And they came out with these crazy cool videos, Will It Blend? They totally grasped how they could use this new medium of YouTube and did fabulously well by creating these videos. And all of the big, you know, the big brands really didn't figure it out because it was such a new medium. And while virtual events have been around for a really long time, I think now people are giving them a new look just simply because in-person events are essentially not happening right now. So what does that mean? That means there's an opportunity for people who are very, very clever about how they approach these events, whether it's an organization like Scaling Up, Vern Harnish's company, deciding to do, instead of a 2-day event, simply a 2-hour event, or Tony Robbins, instead of just doing the normal kind of approach to a studio, creates a 50-foot round screen that can show 2,000 people on Zoom at once, and has 5 cameras in that studio, and completely reimagine what's possible around a virtual event. And any organization, even a small organization or one with very little resource, has an opportunity to do something that can be really cool and really jumpstart their business and put them on the map because this is such a new medium. It's not new in the sense that virtual events have been around for a while and the traditional old school webinar has been around for at least 15 years. That's not new. But what's new is that people are paying so much attention to these events because the in-person event business has stopped.
Yes, and it seems that there's a sort of democratization going on of events where you often talk about media gatekeepers, you know, in the old days. And, you know, you have the newspapers. You want to get your message out, you had to go through the media or the newspaper. You had to, you know, you had to beg for attention. I'm quoting a bunch of David Merriman Scott. you had to buy attention, or you could bug people one at a time. Whereas now, and it's still, there's still a certain table stakes to doing a live in-person event. I mean, it's yes. just, it's a different game.
It's expensive. You know, you have to hire a room. It requires travel. It's, at a convention center, hotel ballrooms are expensive. You need to have a set and lighting. And yeah, it's expensive.
And so suddenly people who'd never thought of wanting to do an event can put a toe in the water and use something that's been around for a while, but reimagining it to connect with their prospects or their customers, their fans, or things like that. So let's talk about, let's say somebody wants to get a speaker, and there's all different kinds. There's, you can pay for a speaker, you could get somebody to speak for free. And you talk in the book about how choosing a speaker is for a virtual event is very different from choosing one for an in-person event. And you told one horrifying story about a speaker who will not be named. And
who will remain nameless.
And they might get $50,000 to do an in-person event. And so they were brought into to do a virtual event, and they were looking down at their phone.
It was appalling. It was appalling. Yeah, I can't name the speaker. Many people who are listening would know the identity of that speaker if I were to give the name.
So somebody wants to get a speaker, what should they do? And one thing you mentioned was, YouTube people might actually have a leg up.
I would actually make it, you have to insist on seeing a video of the speaker that you're considering hiring for your virtual event, whether you're hiring a paid speaker, professional, or whether you're bringing in somebody who is not charging a fee because they want to represent their company or they've written a marketing book, for example, Douglas.
Or they want to promote their podcast about marketing books.
Or they want to promote their podcast about marketing books. Yeah. Ask the speaker, do you have a recording, do you have a replay of a virtual event you've spoken at recently where I can take a look and see how you present? Because you want somebody who understands some of these things that we've been talking about. They understand how to speak to the camera. They understand how to mix things up so that it remains interesting for the audience. Every 5 to 7 minutes, change up and do something a little bit different. They understand how to create audience interaction throughout the presentation. And you should be able, if it were, let's say, a 30-minute or 45-minute presentation or 20-minute, however long it is, you should be able to get a good sense of whether that speaker, by watching the video, is going to be effective for your particular event. And I think that's a requirement. I think looking at somebody's in-person speaker video is not enough, because they may be fabulous at being able to present in the theater, the theater of the in-person speaking stage, and not be able to pull off what's required to do something virtually. So watch that video, make sure that they're able to pull it off.
Yes, don't just be satisfied that they're a great speaker. Well, they might be a great speaker, but it's different here. It's a very different medium.
Yeah, it's more than just the content. The content is kind of a given. If you hire a speaker, I think it's kind of a given that they're going to deliver good content. But it's how they deliver that's such a variable. And people who are good at that, and people just simply, and it may be because they don't have the experience, or it may be that they just didn't realize that what's possible with a virtual event. Or as we've talked about before, they just do what works on a stage that they've been doing. The speaker I wrote about in the book, who probably has been professionally speaking for 20 years, has probably done 1,000 events or something, and gets $50,000 for a speech, and goes to Las Vegas at least 6 times a year, and, you know, New York 3 times a year, London 4 times a year, you know, was horrific with their virtual event, used a mobile phone, pointing up their nose at the lights. I was just off. It was just horrible, awful. So even though someone might be skilled at an in-person event, doesn't mean they're going to be skilled virtually.
Yes. And you talk in the book about common problems with virtual event speakers. And, you know, after that story, I started to think, wow, this is some of these problems are more prevalent. And one of them is a lot of these virtual speakers may not have the right technology at home.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean,
and that's like lighting and audio and
and it doesn't need to necessarily be a big deal, but little simple stuff like is there good light on their face? Is there not backlighting that causes them to look like, you know, dark and foreboding?
The
like
witness protection program. Yeah.
Some kind of criminal. Yeah. Do they have something that I know you are very persnickety in a fun way about, Douglas, is do they have a good microphone?
Guilty.
No, it's good because you make your podcast sound good because you insist your guests have a good microphone. But is the virtual event speaker, do they have a good microphone? Is a simple thing, but so often it doesn't happen, is the camera at the same level as their eyes as they're presenting and not down looking up their nose or up looking down on their forehead.
Or looking down at their laptop, which is on their table.
Correct. And then we already talked a little bit about the background, but is the background interesting? Are they presenting slides? If so, how? You know, and all of those things are things that can be controlled. And each one of them is an element that's important for that speaker. Now, many virtual events will have, you know, executives from companies and so on who are not professional speakers, and I don't expect that they will have a full-blown studio in their home like I do, but they should be guided by the virtual event manager or the people who are running it. They should be guided for simple things like, you know, do a technology check. You know, your microphone's not very good. Can you buy a new mic? Is there a way that you can turn your table 180 degrees around so that that humongous window behind you is actually in front of you and lights your face? Do you have a stack of 4 or 5 books that you can put under your notebook computer so that it brings your webcam up to eye level, things like that? Mm-hmm. Now, in my case, I present standing up. I'm very rare, actually, in the virtual event world that I present standing up. Almost everybody presents sitting down. But to me, it works better to present standing up. And anybody who does present standing up, that poses a lot of challenges because getting the computer up to eye level when you're standing is a lot more convoluted than having a computer at eye level when you're sitting down at your dining table.
Yes. And another thing you mentioned, which we've touched on, is that the virtual speakers, I gather a lot of them still just don't think to involve the audience in their presentation.
Yeah, they don't because they tend to just do what works in person.
Right.
Typically, you deliver your speech for, say, 35 minutes, and you take 10 minutes of Q&A in an in-person event, and that's frequently what they do in a virtual event. But there's so many ways to involve the audience. Like, for example, what I do is when I kick off my speech, the first thing I do is I ask a question in chat, and my speech is about the prior book that I wrote that you kindly interviewed me for called Fanocracy. So it's about building fans. And I ask people, you know, this is like in the first seconds, literally, of my talk. I say, you know, thank you very much for having me at this event. It's great. Now, everybody, please put into chat what you're a fan of. Could be a band, it could be a sports team, it could be a company, a product, a service, an idea. Put into the chat what you're a fan of. So literally within 15 seconds mm-hmm. of my at the start of my speech, I've built interaction into the event, into my talk. And most speakers don't do that. Most speakers don't do any interaction at all, or if they do, they might just pop in one polling question in the middle. But I think it's important to have interaction approximately every 5 to 7 minutes, you know? So that means if you're doing a 40-minute talk, you know, you might be doing 5 or 6 or 7 different ways that you're involving the audience in just that very short period of time.
Yeah, and it seems like you should take whatever time you're allotted and divide it by 5 or divide by 7 and think of modules.
That's how I do it, and that's a television approach. They think in modules. Mm-hmm. Now they think of segments. You know, what segment are we in now? Oh, this is the B block. This is the C block. This is the D block. That's how television approaches their shows, and I think that's how we virtual event speakers should be approaching our speeches. Okay, what block is this? And in this particular block, do we have some kind of audience interaction? Do we have a different way that we can mix things up? You know, can I show a quick video? Can I bring in a guest? I mean, what can I do to mix things up?
Yeah. Now, you did mention that most webinar platforms are not optimized for interaction, which I was surprised to see. You say they're basically designed for broadcasting information. What if you have to give one, like for instance, you have to give one and it doesn't have much interaction built into the platform. How do you get around that?
Well, these days, most platforms have some forms of interaction. So what I do is I always ask the people who are putting the event on for a technology check. And I also try to email them prior to the technology check and ask them, what platform are you using? And some of them I know pretty well. So, for example, if they're using Zoom, I know that platform pretty well. But if I don't know the platform well, I want to know, is there a chat feature? Is there a Q&A feature? How does it work? Is there a polling feature? How does it work? Is there the ability to create breakout rooms? How does that work? If I were to bring in a guest speaker for 5 minutes, how would that work? Can we be on split screens so that we're both on at the same time? I want to know the answers to all those questions because that will drive how I bring in those different elements. And some platforms do not have a chat feature. I presented just last week, and the platform I used I don't remember which the platform was, but it didn't have a chat feature. The GoToWebinar platform does not have a breakout room feature. So, you know, in some cases, you just got to go with the flow and use what you have and just, okay, there's no, for example, with GoToWebinar, there's no breakout room feature, but I can run a poll, so I'll run a poll.
Yeah, and you know, it seems like I don't do these very often, but whenever I've used a platform for a webinar or a virtual event like that, there's always something that goes wrong, which is important to practice beforehand. And I think that you said that if you're not asked, you try to insist that you be able to do a tech run-through about a week before.
I do. I always insist on that. I just want to be familiar with the platform. And again, I know many of the platforms. I've used I've used a lot of them. I've probably used 20 or 25 different platforms. But I do want to have the tech check so that everybody knows what their role is. And for me, it's very important to have the person who's behind the scenes driving understand what it is I'm trying to accomplish. So that, and for example, with Tony Robbins, at his virtual business mastery event we spoke about a little bit earlier, there were 30 people behind the scenes. And I was physically in a studio, so it was pretty different. But if it's just a smaller event, they're using Zoom and there's a couple of people who are running the event, I want them to know, here are the things that I would like your help on. Mm-hmm. I ask the people running the event, I'm speaking to them now, I want you please to run the polling question. I will feed you the polling question and the answers, but I want you to drive that. I don't want to have to fiddle with the technology to drive that. However, with Zoom, I'll actually run my own videos that I show because I have to make sure ahead of time that they know that they have to allow me access to the Zoom share screen feature ahead of time, so we're not fumbling with that at the last minute. So all of those things can be solved in the technology check.
Yes, and I happen to have read Seth Godin's speaker letter that he sends out to to organizations.
Every time he sends it out, I have seen that one several times. Yeah,
it's really, and it's not a riot act. He's saying, look, these are the things that are going to help make for a better an event for you. And these are, it's not like his list of demands. It's really reasonable. But he just says, explains, you'd be better if you had the room, wider than long or what, all those kinds of things, the mic he's going to use and so forth. And
yes,
but in it, he says almost all the time, the technical people never know what's needed from the speaker. So I would like you to share this with them because they want to do a good job. And then he tries to meet with them beforehand. But sounds like maybe you've experienced the same thing. There's a real disconnect between the people that are producing it and the speakers. Maybe that's more of a live thing. But have you experienced that?
I think there's always a disconnect unless you can solve the problems ahead of time. There's always and I think it's just natural because we're coming at it from different perspectives, different experiences. I have personally never put on a virtual event. Never put one on. I don't know what's going on behind the scenes. I can imagine, which is actually why I co-wrote this book with Michelle, because she has put on many, many events. Mm-hmm. But as a speaker, I know what works and I know what we need to do. And so that's why having that technology check is working. And it's, as you were talking about Seth, it was funny. I was thinking, it's not about the brown M&Ms, it's like, please remember that famous story.
The Van Halen story. Yeah.
Yeah. We when you serve M&Ms, you have to remove all the brown ones. And the reason they were doing that is they just want to make sure that they read the rider. And it's the same thing is true with speaking, is we don't put all these demands in to be difficult. We put it in because we know that it will make for a better event.
Yeah, that's right. As I recall, Van Halen would say no brown M&Ms. And the reason why is because I'm sure they didn't dislike brown M&Ms, but they realized that on their shows, there were a lot of pyrotechnics and the stages had to be built a certain way. And they were worried about the audience getting injured or the band getting injured. So if they saw no one red, if they saw brown M&Ms, it means they didn't read the safety instructions.
Yeah. If you didn't read the rider, then, and I do that myself. I don't have a brown M&M clause, but I do say that, some simple, this is for my in-person events, simple stuff. Like I want a bottle of room temperature water unopened. It's real easy. I'm not being demanding. I'm not being a diva, but probably only 20% of the time is my water bottle waiting for me. So it's like, and then I know when there is my water bottle is waiting for me that this is going to go really smoothly, that they're prepared. And if my water bottle isn't waiting for me, that's how I know that I'm going to have to go through again, even though I already did it in a phone call, go through again how this is going to go down. And I think the same thing is true of virtual events. You just, you don't do the brown M&M thing, but you do want to make sure that the speaker's requirements and the event's requirements are aligned.
Yes. So I want to quote from one other section of the book. You write, so the event is planned. The technology is in place. The speakers are booked. The sponsors are secured, and you are getting close to the big day. Hmm. Now you need to get as many people registered as possible. It is time to get the word out to as many people as possible and ensure that they have a smooth journey from promo message to post-event survey. Wait a minute, David Merriman Scott. If you just put on the event, people will come to it, right? What are some of the most important things to do to promote the darn thing, which I think a lot of people who put all the time into preparing the event don't realize that they need to be, you know, working on their marketing and promotion of the event.
Well, first of all, if the virtual event is taking over from what had traditionally been an in-person event, like, for example, you and I have met a couple of times at HubSpot's Inbound conference.
Yes.
And as we're recording this show, just last week was their first virtual Inbound. And I thought HubSpot did a great job with their communications to their existing mailing lists of people who have been to the in-person events over the past, whatever it is, 10 years, of what to expect that's going to be different in the virtual event and what is going to be some of the things that are the same. So that's the first thing is make sure that you're reaching out to those people who are already your fans and have already participated in your in-person events. And so they know what to expect with the virtual events. I think the other thing, and there's a bunch of other things we can talk about, but make it clear if you are or are not allowing replays of that event.
And yes.
I have another topic we could rabbit hole.
That's a great can of worms, though.
Should you allow replays or not? We can talk about that later. But you want to make it clear that if you are not allowing replays, that everyone knows that, so that they have to participate live. And then I think also something that a lot of virtual events fail to do is involve the speakers in the promotion. So for example, I always offer, can I shoot a quick promo video, 1 minute video from you from my studio that you can share, to generate interest in your event? And I just says, hey, it's David Merman Scott here. I'm really looking forward to this event. It's happening on such and such a date. I'm going to be talking about how to build fans for your business. I hope to see you there. And I just, you know, create that little video and put it out for them. I'm often happy to share on my social networks the fact that I'm going to be speaking at that event, which helps to, in some cases, sell tickets. And I never expect that I'm to be given any compensation for doing that. I just do that as part of my participation in the events. But sometimes what they'll do is they'll give me a promo code. And I think this works the best. I'll get a promo code that gets some percentage, 20% off or $50 off or whatever the price point is, for my tribe. And I'll say, hey, I'm speaking at such and such event. I'm going to be talking about this topic. Here's a promo code for $50 off your ticket. And then I think that's a great way for an event to leverage the speakers that are part of that event. And it's not, doesn't happen very often. And then I think they should have all of their employees, as appropriate, be talking about that event and sponsors and others, so that everyone sort of is getting that word out that, hey, this thing's coming up and we're super excited about it.
Yes. And in the book you talked about, that's actually one of the problems with the virtual event speakers is that they don't forge a true partnership with the event planners.
A lot of them don't. They just expect, especially the professional speakers, and they just say, hey, you know, you pay my fee, I'm there, and that's what my job is. But I believe, my personal philosophy, I believe that it's a partnership. And the more I can do to help the event to be successful, the more I feel I'm valuable, not just as a speaker, but as a partner to that event.
Yes, and they might even invite you back.
That would be nice.
It's all about repeat business. Now, David Merriman Scott, you mentioned a promo code. Just in case people haven't been keeping track of this, if you go to newmarketingmastery.com, which is the phenomenal marketing course that David Merriman Scott has developed with Tony Robbins, a while back, David offered $500 off to Marketing Book podcast listeners if you put in promo code Marketing Book. So, David, that was very generous for the listener. Thank you for doing that. I think that that would be money well spent, particularly since you can't go to a conference and other people at your firm can use the same program.
Absolutely. Yeah. So thank you for mentioning that, Douglas. But I do want to touch on that concept we just talked about real briefly. And should you allow replay?
Yes.
I am a huge believer that a live in-person event is more valuable if the audience is live, that they can participate in the interaction, the chat, the polling features, the Q&A, the breakout rooms, as opposed to just passively watching later. That's what TED Talks are. TED Talks are events that, you know, happened in the past, last year, 2 years ago, 10 years ago, that you can watch passively at your leisure.
Right, and there's a line in your book where you say a virtual event should not be a collection of TED Talks.
Correct. And I think as soon as you allow everything to be available on replay, you're doing that. So there's a lot of interesting models that that virtual events are playing with, where some are saying you have to watch live. There is zero replay. It's not going to happen. And I've participated in some of those, and it's been interesting. There's some that say keynotes you can replay and watch later, but all of the other parts of the event you have to watch live. There's one event that I saw recently that I was a speaker at where the live portion was less money than if you watched the replay, which I found fascinating. So if you wanted to participate live over a day at that event, you paid one price. I don't remember what it was. Call it $100. But if you wanted to watch the replays at a later time, it was $250. So I thought that was really, really interesting as a way to drive people to the live, to participate in that event live. So there's different models of pricing that that organizations can do to try to get as many people to watch live as possible.
I find that when I sign up for a webinar or some sort of event, I see it's going to be recorded. I don't always attend, and then I end up not watching.
What happens? This is very, very, very common in virtual event businesses. You sign up, and you expect to watch the replay, and you have all good intentions, and you never do.
Right. That's me. Yeah. But when I see, and it's rare, when they say, we're only doing this live, we're not going to record it, it's like they're doing me a favor because they're making it more of a priority for me, and I tend to attend those.
And I think that is an emerging approach that I'm a big fan of, that I really like. I really like to see virtual events that do that.
So, David, one of the last things I want to ask you about, which is something that just warmed the cockles of my heart, and that's where you said you really should be thinking about the purpose of your event. Like, talk about, you know, goals and success measurement. You know, because I see, well, sadly, it's sort of like marketing where they'll say, go do some marketing, whatever that is, you know? And it's like, let's do an event. Well, no, what are some of the things that people should be looking at, you know, key performance indicators? Why are they doing that?
So firstly is, if it's an in-person event that you're bringing virtually, I would first ask the question, do we really need to do that? I mean, you know, okay, we've had this in-person event for the last 12 years, and people expect us to have it, but we can't because of COVID-19. And so we should do a virtual event. Well, wait a minute. Should you? You don't have to, right? You can rethink that whether you should or not. So I would suggest that you do that. If the event is one designed to generate revenue, and I've shared a couple of those types of events over the last few minutes that we've been chatting. For example, my buddy Vern Harnish, who ran that event that I talked about, that's became a 2-hour, 10-minute each speaker event, or the Tony Robbins event. Those are events that are designed to generate revenue. So, okay, how many people do we expect? What's the price point? What's our expected revenue? What's the goal we're going to set? And then for other events where the primary goal is to is to get people to attend and then hopefully become a fan and eventually buy a product or service from us. The HubSpot Inbound Conference is a good example of that. What's the goal for how many people we want to have attracted to the event? What's the goal for how many people who then to go to the next step? And what is the path that we want them to take from that virtual event to engage with us and potentially do business with us down the line? So those things really ought to be thought through and not just, oh, well, we got to do an event, so let's just get it done.
Yeah, and generating sales leads.
And generating sales leads, right?
Yeah, that's another one.
Exactly right. And then put a goal on it. And, you know, you won't necessarily hit the goal. You may wildly exceed it. I've seen people have had their wildest expectations have been doubled, tripled, quadrupled. It's like, oh my God, how the hell do we pull that off? But at least if you have a goal, you have a way to measure.
Agreed. And also, it seems like if you can live through the first one, if you survive, you can. It'll be easier to do the second year. But what can everybody going into it agree to determine if you want to do it a second time?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly right. You know, and so here's another thing around measurement is, I'm a professional speaker, professional in-person and professional virtual speaker. I generally collect a speaking fee when I present at a virtual event. So if you're thinking about doing a virtual event and you're thinking, should we hire a professional speaker or not? Should we pay a speaker fee or not? Well, what's the goal and how will that paid speech help us to achieve the goal? Will it generate more people who buy a ticket or who get a free ticket because we've got a speaker who's, for whatever reason, known somehow? Are we likely to have more people who say good things about us on social media if we have a professional speaker that we pay? Because you want to know the next year, is it worth it to cut that check for a professional speaker?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you don't have the money for a professional speaker, all I need is a bottle of scotch. But it's got to be good scotch. Come on, people.
Yeah.
I was asked to speak at for a business school. There's a listener in France.
Nice.
Olivier Guérin. And I just butchered the pronunciation, but I'm trying to impress all my listeners in France. And I spoke at an alumni event for the business school, and they sent me two bottles of very fine adult beverages from France.
Oh, that's, aren't you lucky? That was worth it.
David, I'm cheap, but I'm not easy. No, I'm kidding.
That's awesome. Good for you.
So, David, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I think it's this, that just simply taking what you know about in-person events and slapping it into a Zoom room doesn't work. Yes. You need to reimagine what's possible and create a new kind of experience for a virtual event.
Absolutely. That's, you talk about in the book about they don't take what they know. They actually try to recreate it. They're trying to refashion it so that, like, I guess maybe the early days of radio, rather than reading a newspaper, you start to bring in actors and have a radio drama. So that was probably a breakthrough for radio. Well, are there any new or other new or upcoming books that you've heard of that you look forward to reading or seeing come out? I know you know a lot of
I'm super excited for Seth Godin's new book. I believe it's out very early November. November 3rd. I've read every book Seth has ever written. I should say every marketing book Seth has ever written. And very, very excited for that one.
Yes. And I've interviewed him about it and I absolutely loved it. Great interview. And that'll publish here on the Marketing Book Podcast on November 6th. And I believe you said you're actually going to interview him tomorrow for some of the content you're creating.
I am. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, do give him my best. And also best regards to his dog, Baxter. And my dog, my co-host, Monty, is here on the floor, and he's been really quiet and very, very cooperative.
Good for Monty. Has Monty virtually met Baxter?
I don't think so. But Monty, I'm sure, would send good vibes because Monty's a very friendly, very happy dog. So at marketingbookpodcast.com, we'll include links to lots of things that are linkable. We're going to include links to your site and several of the articles you've written, including the article that just came out today announcing this new book. And I happened to mention on LinkedIn this weekend that I was going to be interviewing you, and I do hope I didn't get anybody in trouble.
No, it's funny because I was like, ooh, Douglas spilled the beans, but that's cool. I'll let Douglas spill the beans.
I'm sorry.
No, don't worry about it. It's all good. You're one of the very few people that I wouldn't say, take that down.
Well, I did include a link so that people could buy it.
No, it's good. It was good. I'm glad.
When I went on Amazon, I saw that you already had reviews and everything. So,
yeah, no, there's a few people who I gave some very early copies to, and who kindly were willing to review it on Amazon. But it's out now, and I'm excited for that.
Terrific. That's great. And for you, dear listener, if you're listening on your smartphone and you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found by going to this episode and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is Standout Virtual Events, How to Create an Experience That Your Audience Will Love. The authors are David Meerman Scott and Michelle Manafi. David, thank you very much for returning for the sixth time, Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you six times in a row, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who've left an iTunes review, I would like to return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I will drop it in the mail to you. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, and I read every book featured on this show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.